everybody. This is William Del Pilar, and this is Fired Up, your source for conservative talk. Before we get into the show, I want to share a few thoughts on the debate between qualifications and loyalty. And in a perfect world, you want a combination of both. In life, we grow and mature as human beings, whether as young men or women transitioning into adulthood. This growth includes our business maturity as well, or acumen. Our greatest leaders, scientists, athletes, entrepreneurs, you name it, will tell you they have learned and grown through their own mistakes and failures. Politics is no different. Yet many people are upset with Donald Trump after he was burned by the establishment during his first term by listening to those who purposely advised him to surround himself with certain individuals, only to discover that these were establishment figures beholden to their donors or the military-industrial complex. These same individuals who colluded with the mainstream media to promote themselves and take down a presidency at the expense of our country. Is it any wonder that President Trump is now following the business practices that transformed him from being a millionaire into a multi-billionaire? That business practice is loyalty, my friends. I have practiced that, both in the military and civilian world. The most successful business people in the world will tell you that loyalty is a key component of their success. Yet in politics, there is a consternation amongst most bureaucrats, career politicians, and an ideological driven mainstream media over his current choices. These same individuals who have never built anything at all during their lifetime and instead have made a career off the American taxpayer or reading a teleprompter, they have consternation that President-elect Trump, who learned the hard way during his first term that he needs his own formula for success, a formula that has loyalty as the main ingredient, as a necessity for a successful second term. Is Lloyd Austin, as a four-star general, more qualified than Pete Hegseth, a major in the Army? Yes, he is. However, Austin is part of the military-industrial complex, formerly of Raytheon, and has been involved in awarding Raytheon $30 billion in contracts through the Pentagon, obviously raising concerns about the influence of former board members on defense procurement decisions, raising the question of who he's really serving. Is it the American people and his soldiers? I think not. But hey, he's a four-star general. He's qualified for the job. A general who continues to support needless wars and supported unnecessary deaths, including the tragic loss of 13 soldiers in Afghanistan, purely to support a president and his political optics, without ever reaching out to console the families or accounting for why 13 lives were murdered needlessly. This four-star general may be qualified on paper, but his actions and performance prove he should never have been given the job despite those lofty credentials. Yet the pundits, purely for ideological and TDS beliefs, support him. Is John Brennan more qualified than Tulsi Gabbard to be part of the intelligence community hierarchy? Yes, he is. But it is John Brennan who has undermined this country, who voted for the communist presidential candidate while in college, who lied under oath to the Senate about the CIA spying on Senate staffers and yet not being held accountable, who lied to the public about Obama's drone war, claiming they never killed any civilians, who helped get the Russia collusion hoax off the ground to undermine a presidency, and lied that the Hunter Biden laptop was fake and Russian disinformation. Who's he truly loyal to? The American people? I think not. Maybe character should be part of the process. Character. Now, that's an oxymoron if I ever heard one when talking character in politics. Before you judge Donald Trump's picks from your couch, where your only qualification is reading a headline or listening to a mainstream media talking head who suffers from TDS or ideological bias, you might want to take a good look in the mirror before deeming yourself holier than Jesus Christ and more qualified than Trump to be judge, jury, and executioner of these selections. But hey, we all know that never stopped critics from becoming a 700-pound gorilla behind their computers in their mom's basements. Sadly, this is the America we now live in, where tribalism rules and damn the consequences. We've got an exciting show for you today. So let's get to it. Hello, everybody. I had to get that off my chest, you know, to the audience. Let's welcome G. Mangani and the beautiful Miss Annette Ross. And I'd like to welcome our special guest, Richard Bailey, the former mayor of Coronado. Richard, if you'd be kind enough to let the audience know a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, thank you, William. I'm actually the current mayor of Coronado for one more month, and then I will be an unemployed politician and happy to be so. I've been in public policy for 12 years, 4 years as a council member here in Coronado, and then 8 years as the mayor. I also served on SANDAG as a board representative during that time. When I'm not in the public policy sphere, I have a few small businesses, and I'm also really big into mountaineering. I just got back earlier this year from summiting the tallest mountain in the world, Mount Everest. So that's a little bit about me.
Oh, wow. Well, and my apologies. I thought you were a former mayor for some reason. I apologize.
Soon to be.
There you go. And so, guys, thoughts on the opening there. We're hearing a lot of talk negatively, mostly about Trump's picks because they're unorthodox. G, your thoughts, and then we'll go to Annette and Richard.
Well, the negativity you hear is from the left. And you know you're doing something right when the left is mad. And when The View is my gauge, when they're literally losing their minds, you know that Trump's doing something right. And you're right. Like, you got to value loyalty. I think the first term, he was trying to keep his enemies close. But the problem is he put his enemies in positions of power where they can undermine him. So now he's putting loyalists in, which is the right way to go about it.
Correct. And Ms. Annette, your thoughts?
I'll be brief because I'm listening to be more concise. No, I think that I was with the Republican Women's Group just the other day at a luncheon, and they were all fired up, really excited that he's having strong picks. He's learned from his mistakes. I think he's learned. He's more seasoned now, right? And I think he's really unafraid. So I think he's being really bold in his picks, and I think it's exciting.
So, Richard, as the mayor, who I view as a rising star in the party, what are your thoughts when you hear all these candidates, these nominations, potential nominations?
I think Trump is fulfilling his promises, right? He's always promised that he's not going to do the same thing that has been done for the past 4 years, and he's giving voters something to be excited about. Now, as you mentioned, these appointments are a bit unorthodox, but I would point out and I would raise the question, well, how has the last 4 years been working out with more conventional picks? Are we healthier today as a nation than we were 4 years ago with, you know, the current HHS secretary? Are we more secure today than we were 4 years ago? And if the answer is no, then we really need to be reevaluating what types of people we want in these positions of leadership.
I agree. And for the audience out there, we are going to talk about some of these cabinet picks. We're going to talk about if the San Diego Republican Party can ever learn how to win again. That's my personal belief. I don't want to put that on the panel there. And I'm proud to say California is pushing back against more taxes across the state and in San Diego. But before we get going, do not forget to like, share, and subscribe to this podcast. Now, before we get into some of these cabinet picks, I wanted to review recess appointments. Donald Trump, before they voted John Thune in as the Senate Republican leader, said, "I want recess picks." And all the candidates said, "Yes, we will do that." And in essence, what that means is when Congress is in recess, they can appoint picks to fulfill the position until the next go round. And right now, John Thune actually came out this evening and said, "Well, we don't have enough votes to have a recess appointment." Now, John Thune is very tightly connected with Mitch McConnell, and him and Trump aren't really too tight. However, for the audience again, if John Thune comes out and says we don't have a recess, the House can do a recess, and if they recess, the president has never done this in history, but the president has a right to recess Congress. And then from there, it's a matter of waiting 10 days for a recess before the appointments can begin. For the audience, Barack Obama made 32 recess appointments, Bill Clinton 139, George W. Bush, 171. Donald Trump and Joe Biden did not make any. And I think that's because of more tribalism over the last few cycles. So let's get right into it. Richard, we'll start with you here. Your thoughts when you heard Marco Rubio being nominated for the Secretary of State?
Look, it's clear based on Marco Rubio's comments, he understands that peace through strength is what Trump's platform is. That's what Trump ran on. And that is what he is certainly positioning himself as now, as the potential Secretary of State. So I expect Marco Rubio is going to sail through confirmation.
I expect him to sail through. His popularity with conservatives is another thing. Gee, your right. thoughts on that?
Well, you might have seen the recent video on X where some people were trying to corner him by saying, don't you care that Israelis are killing civilians in Gaza? Yeah. And he said, actually, I care a lot about that, but that's Hamas's fault. And make sure you post that video on X. And he totally took the argument and did a kung fu on them. So I think he's good. He's going to be a great Secretary of State because he's already thinking through on how to attack, especially the arguments made by the left. But on the world stage, he'll know how to handle our friends and our enemies.
Miss Annette, your thoughts on Mr. Rubio, who at one time was a young up-and-comer and is now a veteran in the Senate.
Yeah, actually, I saw that same little clip, and I was really impressed with him because I thought, wow, he's a lot stronger than I realized. I don't really know a whole lot about him, and I was impressed with that he was actually – I find it hard, even being just in a tiny little school board role, to sometimes say the tough things that I'm really thinking. And, I mean, when we put him up against Blinken, okay. So I'm super excited. It's going to be refreshing.
So – Big John, our producer, and I'm not a Rubio fan. Rubio's never held a job in the private sector. That kind of bugs me and people who don't do that and they go into government service. So that's a personal issue. But he's also an establishment type guy. He had the Gang of Eight. I don't know if you guys remember that when the first immigration. And I don't want to dwell on it too much, but Big John and I were thinking one thought process that him and Trump aren't actually allies per se. Now, Rubio voted a lot with Trump's policies the first time he was president. So we were just bandying about. Maybe this is how he gets Rubio a potential thorn in the Senate if he sides with the establishment on certain issues. Maybe he gets him out of the Senate this way, gets DeSantis to appoint a Trump supporter to replace him. And if Rubio does well, he keeps the Secretary of State job. If not, he becomes like Rex Tillman and is out of there. Now, are we way out there with that conspiracy theory or not? Let's start with G, then Annette, and we'll end it with Richard.
I could see that. I could see Trump. But, you know, Rubio did go on the campaign trail for Trump. And, you know, Rubio is more of an establishment guy, but I think he's seen a little religion in the last 8 years. But I still think he's angling for 2028. Someone's got to carry the torch from there. So I think Rubio's playing ball here so he can run, and he would have to announce in about 2 years, right, for that race. Yep.
I can't argue that at all. I do think he's angling for 2028. And what about you, Ms. Ross?
I just think that there's layers to it. I mean, I think these picks aren't always exactly what they seem. And there's the politics of how you're going to, like, put the pieces on the board in this chess game. And Trump's going to be very clever about it. It's not just going to be always going to be Secretary of State. As you said, there's going to be other pieces as well that help him build this coalition and maybe strengthen him in other areas like in Florida.
And Mr. Bailey, real quick too, Richard, did you see Rubio anywhere on the radar for any of these positions?
No. I mean, truthfully, I hadn't been – there's so many names that have been kind of floated out throughout the course of the campaign that I wouldn't have been surprised whoever Trump nominated. And I will say, going back to your original point, though, William, about loyalty. Obviously, Rubio and Trump had a really contentious relationship during the 2016 primary. After Trump became president, you saw Rubio very loyal to the president, especially during this last campaign. And Trump's the kind of guy that rewards loyalty. I think Rubio, as you mentioned, has been a veteran of the Senate now for many years. He's probably wanting to move on to more responsibilities. Secretary of State's obviously a great job that sets you up, gives you a lot of international experience, and sets you up to potentially be a great presidential candidate with that international experience and obviously coupled with your domestic experience here at home as the U.S. Senator. So I think Trump's really rewarding loyalty to Rubio. And given the fact that, you know, Trump carried Florida by 13 points, I can't imagine a state that Trump carried by double digits would have a senator that's going to try to get in the way of the president's platform and advancing the president's agenda. So that's kind of where I think it's coming from, more of a place of loyalty than anything else.
You know, you can't argue that point. I actually, yeah, that's very true. And to G's point, I think this becoming Secretary of State is arguably, to me, the most prominent cabinet position, and does set him up with visibility for 2028 to put him on par with J.D. Vance and Vivek Ramaswamy, who I think are the two, maybe DeSantis in there, but poor DeSantis compared to those two guys, he's kind of boring, you know? So let's move on to probably the most controversial pick of them all. And this one here took me a jaw. I did not see this one coming either. And that is Matt Gaetz for Attorney General. Now, when I see Matt Gaetz, I see Trump rewarding loyalty, and I see Trump thinking my previous attorney generals all threw me under the bus, you know. So Matt Gaetz is controversial because he's gone after Republicans, him and McCarthy. In fact, he ended McCarthy's short reign, so he's really gone after the RINOs and the Democrats. What people don't realize is he's an attorney. And when I did not know that until this past week. And then it was one of those aha moments. Like, oh, that's why he's so good when he's grilling people on Congress. So, Richard, what are your initial thoughts? There's been allegations, investigations, sleeping with a 17-year-old underage. The DOJ investigated, decided not to pursue any charges. But the Ethics Committee in Congress, which is very political, and an investigation was started on him by the Democrats, which was supposed to come out this week. And they've already started to leak some of that. With all of that surrounding him, was Trump crazy to nominate him? Or is it the loyalty again? What are your thoughts on all of this?
I have a lot of thoughts on it. But in summary, I think, you know, one of the questions regarding this investigation is going to be, did the Justice Department decide not to pursue charges because of jurisdictional issues? Or was there really nothing there? Now, I think if the ethics investigation does get released, that will clear up a lot of those answers. I do have a prediction, though, on how this Senate confirmation is going to go. I actually predict that there will not be 50-plus Republican senators that will support Matt Gaetz. I really don't think there will be. I've spent some time back and forth to D.C., and Gaetz, rightly or wrongly, is disliked by many members, if not most members of the Republican caucus in the House and also the Senate. And they've made their concerns pretty public for a long time. So I wouldn't be surprised if he falls short of the 50 vote margin, which if that is the case and you couldn't get him through, then you'd have to turn over to a recess appointment. But if Trump senses that putting through someone like Gaetz might jeopardize other parts of his agenda, then Gaetz might find himself out of office because he's already resigned his position to the U.S. House. And typically, if you're a member of the House and you get appointed to a position with the administration, you wait until you're appointed before you resign. And I definitely don't think this is a done deal for Gaetz.
I agree. I don't see him making it through unless it's a recess. And then once he's proven himself through the recess appointment, then maybe it changes the game. But, gee, I also look at it from this perspective. They're doing some number counting. They're probably looking at what senators are up on the Republican side to run up for election in a couple years. And they're looking at endorsements, and there's going to be some trade-offs here because, as Richard said earlier, Trump does reward loyalty here. So, and Matt Gaetz, if there's been anybody who's been more loyal to him, I can't think of one. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, when he was announced, I felt a great disturbance on the dark side of the force, and the liberals were just losing their minds. My initial thought was that you got to have a sacrificial lamb, right? When you're, I mean, Trump is doing this like Tasmanian devil type of let's appoint a bunch of people, and the left can't be mad at every single one of them. So they got to pick one to like focus their fire on. So I thought maybe Matt Gaetz was that person, but then he resigned his seat. So I was a little surprised by that. And I found out that his state has an 8-week lead period before the new Congress is installed. So he's just getting ahead of that 8-week period. So that would be next week sometime. So I'm surprised that he would resign his seat so quickly and not go through this process, because you're right. He might not find himself with a confirmation and he'd be out of a job. I mean, maybe Trump will find another spot for him.
Ms. Annette, what are your thoughts on somebody who's embroiled in such controversy? I mean, he's a young, good-looking guy, had a bright future, but he made a lot of enemies.
Yeah, it's risky. And I was going to just really put it back to all of you. Like, I was thinking, when I heard about it, I was thinking, why would Trump risk it? Because I don't feel I don't know if he will succeed and he'll go through. You know what I'm saying? I just didn't. And then for him to then resign his position, I thought that was a risky move on his part. Like, this is one I don't get. Doesn't seem worth it to me.
Well, Annette, so Big John brought up a point I was going to bring up, too, is the ethics probe was supposed to come out this week. But with his resignation, it's dead. So do you think maybe he resigned partly because of the ethics probe? And looking at the ethics probe, let's be honest, they've tried to politically persecute Donald Trump in the civilian courts, and they tried to impeach him twice. So Donald Trump may go, I believe you. I don't believe the ethics probe nor the DOJ. How do you think that plays into him?
Well, that makes a lot of sense. Except I agree with what Richard said, that he's not very well liked, I don't think, you know, even by his own party.
I agree.
You know what I'm saying? So I agree that maybe Trump is going to say, there's that DOJ again. You know what I mean? Like, he's going to be supportive. He understands what that's all about. They've been weaponizing the DOJ with Trump. So I'm just saying, though, out of all of the picks, even Christie, where we're going to talk about all of them, so I'm not going to digress at all. Just talking about this, it was the one that perplexed me the most. I didn't really understand it. Because I don't find him to be a likable guy either. So.
Gotcha. Right. He's very
brash. He will be attorney general. That's my point too. There's a lot of really talented, qualified people to take that role.
You know, William, G's point about a sacrificial lamb. When you look at all of the unorthodox appointments that Trump has made or is attempting to make, that there's this joke that, you know, every member of the U.S. House wants to be a senator, and every senator thinks of themselves as a future president. And I think a lot of these senators, especially the Republican ones, especially the ones that might be in some swing state elections coming up in the near future, are going to look for ways they can reasonably push back on Trump's agenda just to show some independence to their, say, more moderate voters back home. You know, rejecting a Matt Gaetz appointment or voting no on a Matt Gaetz appointment, I think gives them a lot of cover to do that. And I don't think it's something that will alienate a lot of members within their own caucus. So Matt Gaetz very well might turn out to be a sacrificial lamb.
You know, it's funny because he is the most controversial. I mean, and I do wonder how much Trump is weighing how he's been persecuted by both Congress and in the outside world and putting himself in Gaetz shoes. But I think every reason given is legit. And this is going to be one of, I hate to say it, but one of the fun ones to watch to see what happens with the soap opera drama. All right. So let's head on to a guy. And I actually love the Gaetz pick because I kind of see myself as Gaetz in the sense of, like, I have made my own enemies by speaking ugly truths. And I would think that I wouldn't be like Gaetz, but I kind of look in the mirror and I go, oh my God, that's me. It's kind of like one of those things where you look at yourself and you don't like yourself. But that's who Matt Gaetz is. Now, here's a guy who I wasn't for originally until I did my research, and that is Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth. And I referenced him in my opening. Major in the Army, combat veteran, 2 Bronze Stars, Princeton and Harvard degrees. So he's got the pedigree, but he does not have the experience at all. G, let's start with you. What are your thoughts about Pete Hegseth?
Well, I mean, I was looking at all the ex posts by, you know, people on the left, and they're saying, oh, it's a Fox News host. It's a Fox News host. Well, this guy's a military guy. I mean, that's his latest gig, is a Fox News host. And then I even saw on Fox News the title, you know, the banner at the bottom, Fox News host appointed to Secretary of Defense. And I'm sitting there going, even Fox News is saying he's a Fox News host. So now he has, I mean, maybe that's self-promotion or whatnot, but I mean, he has military experience. And so I, you know, whether he's new at it or whatnot, he's going to have his own advisors to work with him, but he's not totally new to the military. So, you know, for me, I think he's a strong pick. Could there be better, more experienced picks? Sure. But I think he's been in combat. He knows the cost of war. I think he's going to try to keep us out of war and keep that idea of peace through strength that Rubio also believes in.
Correct. Richard, the thing about him that's different from Gates is where everybody seems to be piling on Gates, it's the exact opposite for Hegseth. He has his Republican defenders that are saying, hey, hold on. This guy, as G said, this guy did serve. He's done this. He's done that. What are your thoughts on him?
Well, when you look at someone like a Lloyd Austin, right, a four-star general, when you rise to that level within the military, within any government bureaucracy, it's less about your ability to execute the mission and more about your ability to navigate the political channels that exist. And when you look at a guy like Pete, from everything I've read and heard him say, he understands, like, the main mission of the United States military is, as he put it, to stack up bodies. It's to actually be able to defend the nation. He gets raped down to the fundamentals. He doesn't have time for any of this, the DEI initiatives. He doesn't have time for anything that it distracts from the core responsibility of our military, of the Department of Defense. And I think having someone with that type of mentality at the top of DOD is going to be a nice reminder to everyone below him of, hey, let's get back to our core mission here. And I think that's what's exciting the Republican base.
Yeah, that's true. He was on the Sean Ryan show just last week, and some clips are going around about how, hey, we got a clean house. You know, now our producer, Big John, brought up a very good point, and I'll respond to it. He says he has no administrative experience, and that my take is, before I started one of the most successful fantasy sports business when the internet got going, and I was doing it out of my closet, and I was doing better than CBS Sportsline, ESPN, those people. I was the NFL Network's one of their first fantasy analysts. I had no experience in starting a business up. What I did, as G alluded to here, I surrounded myself with people who were experts in areas that I wasn't. I was a marketer, so I made sure that there were people around me that were better at things than I was. What are your thoughts to the critics that say he has no administrative experience?
I saw the Sean Ryan podcast. I actually love Sean Ryan's podcast. They're great. We should have him on the show sometime. But you know what I loved about him? He has integrity. And to me, that matters a lot more than experience. It does. I mean, I'll take that every time in these roles. He's going to figure out those other pieces that he needs to figure out, especially if it's coming to administration. But you do sense, Richard, that was really well said. Again, I'll say, and you guys were great tonight. It's a really nice refresh.
Right. And to Big John, our producer, he told me the other day, well, he was for war in Iran or Iraq or something. I was like, no, not him. And Big John was right. 20 some odd years ago when he was in college and young and dumb, you know, I will say this to any critic of him. And me and Big John, our producer, my partner, we've gotten into some heated discussions. War is a last resort. War is, for one thing, to kill and subjugate your enemy, period. It's ugly. We use war too much as a tool. I think Pete Hegseth, being a combat veteran, having seen death, he understands you don't go to war. You don't have these forever wars. And he made that clear on Sean Ryan. So that's kind of how I view him. All righty. Well, before we leave that, any final words on Pete? They, all right. Okay. So let's move on to, I love this guy. The borders are Tom Homan. And I love him because he's like a boot camp drill sergeant in your face. He has served for 30 plus years under 6 presidents, including Obama. So he understands. He's one of these types, him, Larry Elder, and there's one other person I can't think of. You can't debate them. You will lose. That's how well he knows the law. Richard, let's start with you. What are your thoughts about Mr. Homan?
Look, government is not governing is not complicated. Securing the border is not complicated. And Mr. Holden, he is not a complicated man. He's a very simple man that understands the importance of border security, and he understands his role in that. And I fully expect that not only will he be confirmed, but he'll be one of the best we've ever had in that position because he's able to speak truth on this, what should be a very, very simple proposition, and that's we are a nation of law and order. We have our borders, and they should be secure. I'm a big fan.
Your family's from India. Mine's from Panama and Puerto Rico. Most immigrants, we flee these countries. Well, not in my case, but under Panama, we flee these countries for law and order. So your thoughts on Tom Homan and bringing law and order back to this country?
No, he doesn't speak nonsense. He just does away with it. And And even the, what was it, CBS 60 Minutes, the host was asking, how do you deport people without breaking up families? And he goes, you deport them together. And, you know, there's just a simplicity to that. Now, I know the reality is going to be a lot more complex, and even Trump alluded to that. I mean, criminals, gang members, easy, right? Families who have, you know, 16-year-olds who were born in this country, that's going to be a lot more complicated and more difficult. And even Trump said, we've got to do things with heart. You can't just deport everyone. But, you know, if you're going to deport the mom, you know, the mom's going to take the child with them. So, you know, so we'll see. I'm a big fan of Tom. I think it's going to bring sanity back to our border policies, finally.
You know, Annette, the guy, he's not a meme, but his videos are all over the place of him shaming politicians in Congress. But I want to ask you a question. We talk about abortion a lot and the perception of it. When the Trump administration starts going to work, cameras are going to be everywhere. You know, see, they're separating families. They're doing this, the optics. You know, Holman's like, just get out of my way. How will the Trump administration and Holman deal with the optics of what the media is going to make out to be families torn apart?
Well, I think that's going to be his challenge. I mean, if you guys watched the whole 60 Minutes piece, and I did watch it, it was really interesting because I thought, and I think what might come up is the expense of doing the deportations. They made a big deal about that. Like he said, you know, we'll begin with people that are criminals, right? But there's so many more. And finding them and getting the teams together to go and make this happen and then putting them on planes. Just the logistics of all of it was a lot more comprehensive than I realized and understood. And there is a big price tag to it. I think that will be interesting if that starts to happen and there's a lot of money spent there, how people will feel about that. And then, yeah, then there's the part that, listen, don't get me wrong, I love the guy. Because he is straightforward and because he has the stones to do it and he's just going to say it the way it is. He said, listen, if someone's illegal, he said that too. He said, if someone's doing something illegal and I take them away from their child then, right? I mean, so it happens all the time. So, you know, you can't really argue that. But, yeah, people are sensitive to that. And, of course, they're going to play it up. And, I mean, at the end of the day, I know, William, you disagree with me on this, and you said everyone is in their basement. I thought that was a funny comment. But, I mean, I do think really most people are heartfelt people. I do. I think most people are good, innately very good, and they want to see families together. It's going to be how they do it is going to be really important, and it's going to be, I think, delicate. They should do it delicately.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
Talk about the price tag real quick. So you never heard the media asking Biden or Harris – about the price tag of flying people in from Haiti and Venezuela and giving them debit cards and putting up in these fancy hotels in Manhattan. There are no, like, can we afford this? Is this right to do? Should the American taxpayer pay for this? But now Trump's getting into office and now all of a sudden these price tag questions come into play. It's like, am I living in the alternate reality here?
Yeah, I'm not going to push back, but I will say this. It's both sides. I mean, Trump, the talk about our deficit when he was one of the worst in blowing it up, it's both sides do it. So I expect that battle. He's going to get a lot of support from Latinos who the Democrats thought would loathe this. But we are a simple people. I think, Richard, you said it best when you said he's a simple guy. He looks at it as in black and white. You know, you're here illegally. You broke the law when you crossed the border, period. End of story. That's how he looks at it. I think this is going to be, I don't want to say cleansing. That's a terrible word to use in this situation. But I believe a lot of these low-paying jobs, that's where our kids in the 50s and 60s and 70s, that's where they learned accountability, responsibility. You know, yo, son, yeah, I got you a job at the farm. What? Yeah, you can pick strawberries, you know? And these are jobs that they say Americans won't take. Well, they won't take them when these illegals are being paid $4 an hour under the table. And, of course, I'm exaggerating, but to make the point, you know, those wages will come up. We may get hit a little bit in our pocketbook, but I think in the long term, it's saving our country with our future. Because I think our children today, there's missing years now in learning responsibility, learning what it takes to be go from a young man into a man, to go from a young girl into a woman. So So let's move on. My our producer is like, I sound like a communist now. Not at all. So let's get to, again, speaking of my producer, he brought this up, and he's absolutely right. The Department of Government Efficiency. Is that Doge or Doge?
Doge as in Dogecoin.
That's what I was thinking, Dogecoin. Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, my producer is absolutely right. They technically have no power. Anything that they recommend, Trump's going to have to do via executive order, or he's going to have to go through Congress. These are two of the most high-profile Republicans. I don't want to say conservative, because Elon was just a Democrat a few years ago. But two of the most high-profile positions.
So was Vivek.
That's right, Vivek, too. So let's start with Ms. Annette there. What are your thoughts? Oh, actually, my producer chiming in again. So it was Trump 10 years ago. So, Ms. Annette, what are your thoughts when you hear about Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy becoming government efficiency to clean out billions? They want to clean out billions. Elon has said he wants to get rid of 70% of government workers if possible.
You mean, do I think they can do it? Do I like it? Do I like them? Elon's quirky, right? And he's interesting to listen to. He's tough to listen to. Ever hear him on a long interview? That's tough. Vivek, I could listen to him all day long. He's just brilliant. And I think together it'll be really interesting. I love both those guys. Really excited about it, actually. But I don't know.
Richard.
But wait, quickly, I have no idea what they're actually going to do. Like, I didn't really understand it.
I think they're going to be pretty much number crunchers. They're going to be accountants, for lack of a better word. And I mean, you saw some of the stuff. I remember 15 years ago, I was reading in this book called A to Z, Government Waste, how they had shrimp on treadmills. Shrimp on treadmills, you know. They also paid millions to measure the speed of ketchup being poured. So there's a lot of waste that goes on. Richard, your thoughts. Can these two guys actually get anything done?
They can. They certainly can. And now a lot of people forget that we already have a government accountability office that is basically the internal auditor, if you will, of everything Congress does and all these budgets that get passed. And they provide annual reports of a lot of waste. They'll highlight a lot of examples of waste and make recommendations to get rid of this waste. The problem with the GAO is that it doesn't have any political horsepower, right? The GAO can make recommendations all day long, but at the end of the day, Congress oftentimes ignores these recommendations. But when you have someone like Vivek and you have someone like Elon Musk, who are very, very popular for the Republican base, but they're also two individuals that have a lot of crossover appeal with moderates and even some Democrats as honest brokers of the truth. And so I think when it's Vivek and Elon Musk releasing their recommendations and highlighting the waste, much of it will probably be the same waste the GAO highlights, it will light a fire under Congress to take action to eliminate that waste. So that's what excites me most about it.
I agree. To add on to that, G, I think the fact that Elon owns X and is probably going to highlight a lot of this waste on X will serve as getting the public riled up. Your thoughts on these two?
Yeah, so let's not forget that Elon and Vivek were very successful. I believe Vivek was also a billionaire company owner.
He's close to it, if not already there.
Close to it, and Trump is as well, and Elon. So Elon is going to be way too busy with his companies, right? So he's going to maybe, you know, spend the first few months devoting himself to this, but then he's going to pull back and focus on SpaceX. But they're going to pull it together and say, look, we don't need the Department of Increasing Dolphin Fertility. Like, what kind of stupid jobs are out there in the government? And now, you know, you read the newspaper and they say, oh, yeah, well, they just figured out that caffeine – not enough caffeine will cause headaches, and too much caffeine will cause headaches. And they spent like $100 million on this study, right? I'm being exaggerating as well, but it's like, why are we spending money on this? I know that just from drinking coffee myself. So I think they'll do a great job saving us money. But I do think the money saved will just be a drop in the bucket. Our federal government budget is just way too huge, but it's better to go in that direction than the opposite direction.
Right. Our producer said those two will be like a Cato Institute. But I think, Richard, you're correct in your analogy in looking at them. And all right, let's move on. I mean, there are tons of picks, but I just wanted to focus on a few of the bigger name ones. But let's move on to – I said Matt Gaetz was probably the most controversial, but I may be wrong. It could very well be Secretary of Health and Human Services nominee now, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Gee, let's start with you. I mean, he is still a Democrat. He has no issues in saying, hey, I like Trump, could be one of the greatest. But he has no issues in saying who and what he is. First of all, do you think he'll even get past the Senate, as controversial as he is? And what are your thoughts on him as a candidate?
I think he'll be passed by the Senate, because I think people know that Trump's there because RFK joined the team. And that swung that extra 2% over to Trump. I mean, I listened to him, and I agree with, you know, making our food pyramid, like destroying that, because we know that's false. Grains is not the bread and butter of our diet and shouldn't be. So I think he'll overhaul that thing. But then his approach to pharmaceuticals, like, yeah, you can make these drugs like $5 per pill or whatnot, but then you're going to stop innovation. Because you're not going to – you also have to pay for all the drugs that didn't pass, right, the FDA approval. They didn't make it to market, and the companies have to make up that money as well. So that's embedded in the cost of the pharmaceutical, at least for some number of years. And I think he's going to go to war against the pharmaceutical industry, and I don't think that's necessarily a good idea. We should make sure that pharmaceutical price gouging is not happening. That I would agree with. But pharmaceuticals need to make money in order to, you know, cure cancer and cure all the other things that they're working on. So I'm happy that he'll be there, but I'm not going to agree with everything that he's going to start pushing.
Well, a dirty little secret on the pharmaceutical companies, I did a paper on them. Granted, it was, gosh, I'm showing my age here, maybe 25 years ago, 30 years ago. For many of these drugs, they are reimbursed 70 to 80% of the government. The government goes in with these pharmaceutical companies on a lot of these drugs in the research, because if not, they wouldn't go into it because of their rare diseases, things of that nature. That's on top of the 17-year license they get. So I think there is room in that to push back against the pharmaceuticals. In defense of the pharmaceuticals, there are agreements in place with these United States of America, and I assume Europe too, for a big pharma to give away or at low price to give these drugs out, like to Africa, the poorer nations, and they're allowed to jack up the price a bit in ours. So it's a very complex situation. I do think Big Pharma needs to be brought down to size a little bit. But as G said, they play an incredibly important role. Look at AIDS today. You can now take a pill. My brother-in-law died because of HIV AIDS. And now today, he would be alive today. You know, I mean, that's just the progression of how Big Pharma works. Your thoughts on Robert F. Kennedy and it?
Well, I think he is an honest broker. And I could not agree with him more, probably, than anyone else. And I feel like I know more. I've read a lot of the things he's written. He's extremely intelligent. I think we have way too many drugs. We are fed drugs. Those drugs are promoted. No, they are. He is right to say, let's get healthy.
Oh, I agree with you.
That's really, so gee, I agree with you because you don't want to squash innovation. But what I think is that then you know what? Cure my spinal cord injury. Spend some time on that. Instead of all the nonsense that they have out there, because they push the drugs that can obviously go to the most people. And a lot of those people they change their mind about cholesterol levels. They change their mind about what the blood, well, not really as much about blood pressure, but everyone's on a blood pressure medication. I just want to say, in my 50s, you want to know how many drugs I take? Zero. And I can't even walk. Zero, not one.
Wow. I find that surprising, only because of the way society's set up in your situation. That is incredible.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm actually really proud of that because I keep my weight decent, not perfect, but I eat pretty well. And I watch the things I need to watch and I whatever, blah, 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 blah. But I do think he's focused on that. He's focused on all the garbage food. He's focused on things like the red dye he's focused on other countries that have already decided are toxic for us and they don't even have them on the, you know, as a part of what they can use in their food. And that's just a part of it. But I mean, I think the pharmaceutical companies have been, they push it. And And just let me just tell you one more. I'm sorry. I could go on about this all day, but because I was involved in men pushing drugs on me, where drugs that would honestly, there's a drug called Neurontin. And when you have a spinal cord injury, you have a lot of pain. I have nerve pain. Even now I'm sitting here and my feet are on fire. It's just my nerves saying, you know, they don't work right. But Neurontin is a drug. Actually, they push on you. Yes, it would have taken my pain away, probably, but it inhibits nerve regeneration. So once I read about that, I'm like, oh, wait a minute. Why would I ever want to take a drug that this is my one chance of getting some of my nerves to regenerate? And when my doctor said that, or I actually looked it up myself, I was like, oh, no, thank you. I just feel like they're packaged in a certain way. This is just what we do. This is just the protocol. And when you start saying, do I really need it? And what is the good outweigh the bad in these situations? A lot of times it doesn't measure up. You have to do your own research half the time. It needs an overhaul badly. Sorry.
I think that's a good word, overhaul, or as I said, cut them out of size. Richard, this is a very complex situation. What are your thoughts? I mean, you heard Annette, a lot of truth to what she said. Real quick, when I suffer from cluster headaches, I was on all four, in pain, and I was depressed. And I realized in that moment, oh my God, this is the drug causing me to be depressed. You know, I wasn't thinking suicidal, but in that moment, I realized I was depressed because of the drug. You know, so, I mean, medication is complex. Richard.
Look, America is not a healthy nation. We're just not. And that's the reality of the situation. Is RFK Jr. going to be able to fix our nation's health? I don't think so. Because at the end of the day, individuals are responsible for their own health, right? And if we all exercise more, if we all ate better, we would all be, and we got outside more, our nation would be healthier just from those three things. Now, as it relates to HHS, I do think something RFK Jr. is bringing to the table is he's going to be asking a lot of tough questions. And HHS oversees 13 different divisions, three of the bigger ones, NIH, CDC, and FDA. I think there's things we can all point to over the last several years where those three divisions of HHS have disappointed and have not performed up to the standards I think we as Americans should have for those divisions. And I think he's in a really unique position where he is going to ask really tough questions. He is going to shake things up. And ultimately, I think HHS and these three specific divisions need to be shaken up. And you have to have someone like RFK Jr. that is a bit unorthodox that's going to come in there and he's going to try to implement reforms. I don't think he'll be successful in all of them. And I don't think he probably should be successful in all of them. But asking these tough questions will be healthy for the department.
Gotcha. No, I agree. Real quick, I don't want to dwell on it too long. We got a lot more other topics, but real quick, Richard, does he get past it? And your quick thoughts on his reputation of being anti-vax?
I think he does get past it, confirmation, but I think he only gets past confirmation because the Senate will feel comfortable voting against Matt Gaetz. So Matt Gaetz will be the sacrificial lamb that allows an appointment like RFK Jr. to take place. I think our RFK Jr., now he said a lot over the years, right? So there's stuff you can find over the years that contradict what he's saying today. But I think RFK Jr. is a bit more nuanced than you typically find. And I think when he has an opportunity to explain his position on individual vaccinations, right? I don't think it comes down to, oh, are you pro-vax or anti-vax? There are certainly vaccinations that are beneficial for society. They're beneficial for individuals, like that are undeniably beneficial for society as a whole. But there's other vaccinations where you kind of do have to question, like, well, why are infants getting the hepatitis vaccine when they're infants? And I think those are legitimate questions that do need to be answered, and RFK Jr. is in a position to ask them.
I agree. In fact, one of the Big John is not our producer, is not a fan of RFK, and I brought up the fact that, hey, they're trying to get the COVID vaccine into the kids. The kids don't need it. So that, to me, are red flags. Your thoughts, Annette, real quick, does he get past confirmation? And your quick thoughts on his supposed anti-vax. Richard is correct. I have heard him talk on that, and he says, I'm not anti-vax. And he, as Richard said, some he doesn't agree with, some he agrees with. Your thoughts, real quick.
Yeah. No, he said in the interview that I saw that he vaccinated his kids with some of the sort of the traditional vaccines, you know, the MMR, measles, mumps, rubella. And that's a good question, hepatitis B. Why is any child vaccinated? You know, they come out pretty healthy before you get them out of the hospital. I mean, that has always been something. And I didn't do that. I had my own vaccine schedule for my children. I didn't like that. I like to space them out. I like to give them time to be home, to be nursing, all these things. But he's going to ask tough questions. That's a really good point. I don't think he is an anti-vaxxer. We have more vaccines also than a lot of other countries. And he's going to ask tough questions to see why and are they necessary?
I agree. Gee, we know you said he's going to get past confirmation. We are giving 72 vaccination shots in a one pop to a kid situation. Your thoughts on him and his reputation as being an anti-vaxxer?
Well, at some point when you're an activist, you do say extreme things to gain attention, right? So I think once you're in power, like when I was, as the all four of us, we've all been candidates and we've all governed as well. You might come out stronger as a candidate, but once you're responsible for making proper decisions, you go, okay, now I need to make the right decision. I can't just say whatever I want. And I think he's going to find himself in that situation as well. I think the cocktail of vaccinations, I mean, I think there's a question mark. Why do you have to give so many of them within one shot or within a week's time frame to a little baby? You know, there are good questions there, but is he going to get rid of the measles vaccine? I don't think so. I mean,
no, I agree.
Watch the epidemic, you know, just explode across the United States. I mean,
polio, right.
It work.
Yeah. We've seen some of that with chickenpox and that because, again, illegals coming in who aren't vaccinated being at the school. So, guys, I wanted just quick thoughts on John Thune. Is G, we'll start with you. Trump ally or not? Or your thoughts?
I think he's Trump ally for the first 100 days. And then after that, I wonder where he's going to be. I feel like he's establishment, and I think he's – but then he might play along for the first 2 years. So I'm on the fence about this one. He might play along because Trump has a mandate. And Trump, I mean, basically won all three branches of government. I mean, in his first term, he won over the Supreme Court, and now he won over both – Houses of Congress and the presidency. So he might play along with most things here. But I know at least for sure the first 100 days.
I agree wholeheartedly with G. I view him as a little bit more establishment and could easily turn on Trump. But Richard, your thoughts on him, Trump ally or not?
My hope is that John Thune, being the institutionalist that he is going to be able to help guide Trump's policy through the Senate chamber in a way that does respect to the institution. So I think Senator Thune can help Trump thread that needle. Trump's obviously not an institutionalist from the standpoint of he's obviously never really been in government other than his 4 years as president. And so my hope is that with someone like a Senator Thune, who should recognize that Trump has a mandate to advance his agenda, serves in that capacity to advance that agenda, but doing it the quote unquote right way. Right, in a way that we haven't necessarily seen our friends on the left side of the aisle try to do. So I am actually a believer in, you know, following processes and procedures that are in place. I think institutions are important, and if we can advance, you know, this conservative agenda by doing it the right way, all the better, because then it just gives critics of Trump even less ammunition.
I agree with that too, Ms. Annette. The Republican side has always been more willing to work with the Democrat side versus the Democrats being hardliners. How do you see Thune working out?
Do you really think that?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah, I don't need to think it. I can show you. I mean, Chuck Schumer, he's threatening SCOTUS. We're coming after you. Then turns around a couple of days ago. Do not forget bipartisanship. We never had it with you guys. You know, so yes, I do believe that. I am actually I have only become a hardcore conservative the last 15 or 20 years after 2000 when I saw a complete shift in not just the media, but how the Democrats started running Congress. So yes, I do believe that.
Oh, okay. So, but your question, Richard, was what you were saying that you think he's the kind of person who's like a rule follower? Is that like procedure? Is that sort of the point about him?
Well, yes, that's what I was saying about Senator
Thune.
I think he's going to try to advance Trump's agenda, but he's going to do so through an orderly process in the Senate. Like, he's going to make sure all the hearings get heard. He's not going to try to jam things up, but he's also not going to try to skip steps. That's my guess.
Like, is he like a thorough and sort of methodical guy? I don't know much about him, so I just don't really know how I can like add to this part of the conversation, William.
Oh, that's okay. That's okay. Yeah, as Richard's saying, he's an institutional guy. Richard, real quick before we move on, do you think because he's an institutional guy, he came out already and said, we don't have the votes to do a recess? I'm like, it's kind of early to be making that call. But he came out tonight and said that.
Mm-hmm. My guess, and this is just a guess, is that Senator Thune recognizes the importance of Senate confirmations because they give legitimacy, greater legitimacy to the appointments if they can get Senate confirmation. So I think he's going to try to force it through that process, preferably as quickly as possible, so they do have that credibility going in. That'd be my guess.
And Richard's right, but here's where I disagree, is the Democrats will ram theirs in, and they'll get whatever they can done, regardless of how the optics look. Because once in power, once approved, however its approval is done, they're going to do what they want. So that's the key difference, is where Thune will be an institutionalist and follow the rules, Democrats, Annette, don't. They're the ones who screwed themselves over with SCOTUS because they broke the rules the first go around with nomination for judges.
I will add that if we believe that, and I do believe that, I think we'll give a certain air of gravitas to whatever it gets passed. Because if Rick Scott was leading the Congress side of things, the Senate side of things, I think there might have been these are just the quote-unquote radicals, and we'll try to undo this in future years. But because it's soon, there might be an anchoring effect going, okay, well, the reasonable people also, quote-unquote reasonable people, also signed on to this and passed it. It wasn't just a bunch of radicals that did it. And it might have staying power, especially with stuff regarding the border and voter ID and all that.
Here's where I have the last word. The X factor all of you are missing is the media creates perception. That's why government shutdown is always blamed on the Republicans, regardless of which side we're on in terms of power. And everything y'all said is true in a perfect world, but with the media creating perception, that's why the Democrats will always get a pass when they abuse, and Republicans can never even get close to the abuse that Democrats do because the media actually does their job and keeps them in check on that. So let's get over to some fun. And I apologize. I want to keep moving here because I know G's strapped for time. So let's have some fun now. I have strong feelings about the local elections. I want to start with Matt Gunderson and Mike Levin. Mike Levin, a billionaire. It's contrary to most districts. It's a very, what's the word? I don't want to say uppity. It sounds too snooty. It's a more higher income
affluent
district. What's that?
Affluent.
Yeah. Affluent. Thank you. Affluent district. I thought Matt Gunderson, I go to fundamentalist meetings. I come from a fundamentalist family. I'm not a fundamentalist. And when he started his commercials out on national TV, I am a pro-choice Republican. I'm like, you just lost what little fundamentalist vote you had in your district. And they got you on recordings saying how you loathe abortion. So you're not going to get much Democrat support on that end. I just thought he went about it the wrong way. I myself asked him a question at an event, the first event I met you in person, Miss Annette, and I asked him, specifically speaking, how are you going to get Latinos into your fold? What are you going to do? And he gave me 100% political answer. Then when I saw his commercial, I'm like, this guy isn't being true to himself. He's giving the answers that he thinks people want to hear. Gee, let's start with you on that. That's my take. What are your guys' take?
If I remember correctly, so I think Marriott lost by 5%, 5 to 6%, and Gunderson lost by 12%. So I think there is some validity to what you're saying. Highlighting the abortion issue when you don't need to seems like an unforced error. But it also, to me, seems like an experiment. Like, can a pro-choice Republican run on that as a main plank of their platform and succeed? And I think we're seeing that it didn't work. And, I like Matt. I met him a few times during this election season. This is a quote-unquote red wavelet. I don't know how big a wavelet turns into a wave, but he should have been closer than Marriott. But Marriott actually ended up closer in the last both years, 2020 and 2022, than Gunderson was. So
I agree. Yeah. Miss Annette, I think it was a miscalculation. We all thought abortion would play more than it actually did. the economy trumped it much more, but because that's all the Democrats ran. That's all Kamala ran on, was the abortion issue. So I think he miscalculated with that step. I don't know if you know Matt, but I know you've seen him in action. What are your thoughts? And real quick, yes, he did get shellacked. It wasn't close. The last count I got was 56% to 44%, 180,000 votes to 140. Now, that's probably been updated since I last saw my numbers. But what are your thoughts? Miscalculation, not true to himself?
I'm curious about something. You know, I told you that I had lunch with Amy today. And Amy said right at the very end of the election, Nancy Pelosi gave Mike Levin like another $1.5 million. And she's like, I think that money makes that difference. She didn't think that the economy played a big role because you just said this is an affluent area. And are they impacted the way other people are impacted for the things, you know, for the economy pieces? I don't know. Or like, I don't know. I'm surprised by this. Every time I saw Matt, I thought he was great. I thought he was eloquent. I thought he related really nicely with people.
He's a manly looking man. Look at that picture. That's like a Mike Rose.
You know, you're around people and you get a sense for whether or not that they're sincere. And I thought that he was. So I was.
Gotcha.
Oh, stop it. You know what, William?
No. I'm saying I didn't see that. Giving the answers. But that said, I'm in agreement with you. It's a tough district to figure out, Richard, because it's so affluent. It's not the norms. Now, real quick, Richard, though, when we did our post-election analysis and reviewing some of the exit pollings, we were shocked that a threat to democracy was up there near the very top. So, I mean, this was a tough one to figure out. What are your thoughts on it?
Look, Mike, Congressman Levin does a really good job of projecting that he's a moderate. He's soft-spoken in his language. He's not a flamethrower like AOC or any of the other members of the squad, but his voting record is very left of center. And so his voting record is out of touch with the district, no question about it, but his temperament is very much in line with what that district wants, right? I don't think that district, it's a marginal district in that Democrats have a very slim majority registration-wise, and so
2%.
You can't have a flamethrower on either side, and Mike's certainly not a flamethrower. And so, from his temperament standpoint, he seems to match the district well, but his voting record is super far left. And in a race like this one, so this was the 2024 election cycle, Levin first won in the 2018 election cycle, so he's been through the 2018, the 2020, the 2022. And this is now his fourth election cycle. It is really tough to beat an incumbent. It's just really tough to beat an incumbent. I think that's what it came down to. Name ID was important, and he had it. And he also had the appearance of being a moderate.
I agree. I think the fact it's an affluent district where they can survive a tough economy, life doesn't hit them as hard. My take as a campaign manager, I would have figured out how important is abortion in that district, you know, to the people. And I don't know if he did that. You're right. It's a tough district to figure out because in other districts, you can make it black and white with certain issues. So let's keep moving here. Let's go on to, I love my title, Shock Pikachu. That's the Pokemon detective. You know, Hayes discovers politics. Pikachu, thank you. Gosh, Big John's laughing. He's always, William, you got to learn how to pronounce words. You know, Hayes discovers politics isn't a tea party as DeMaio brings a flamethrower. I have tried to tell people, Richard, we'll start with you, for years, Carl DeMaio fights like a Democrat. The Democrats can beat him because they fight like him. But the Republican side, we seem to always we just don't know how to deal with the DeMaio types. And from day one, and I have no shame in saying this, I met Brian Pepin once or twice, and I believe he was a campaign manager. I would have fired him the night of the primary election. You know, Hayes was completely out of touch. And I love Andrew. I don't think there's anybody on this panel that doesn't like Andrew Hayes. One of the nicest, one of the sharpest kids in terms of knowledge. But I thought Carl came to fight. He fought dirty. I thought Hayes completely underestimated him, and it was pretty much kind of like Mike Tyson in his early years. Let's start with G actually here on this one.
G,
Yeah, I mean, I like both guys. Andrew, I supported and donated to him, and I wanted Andrew Hayes to win. He was the true conservative in that race, and Carl's more of a what would you call it? He's more of a centrist, maybe center right type of guy. But Carl knows how to throw you off your game as a candidate. And you know, I think he tried to get Andrew off the school board by filing something. I don't remember the details of it. But, you know, that is dirty. That is dirty to not only go after you not winning the assembly seat, but also getting you off the school board. And but Carl won, and his tactics worked, and he appealed to the left. And there's some question about whether he's also running a group that it's called Progress California, which is bills itself as a left-wing group. I don't know if that's necessarily true, but I think there were some receipts brought by Amy that is true. So, yeah, you're right. That's a flamethrower.
Richard, before we get to Annette, though, Richard, you have a little bit, I don't want to say history, but when I was first came across your name again, I mean, I knew of you before as mayor, but then I saw San Diego roster where you kind of broke this open. I believe Carl was positioned to win this regardless because of the inroads he'd made. According to Amy Reicher, who Annette already previously mentioned, you know, Tony Kovarik gave Carl the donor list. He's built his little mini empire through Reform California. He's a dirty fighter. And I don't say that in a bad way. Politics is ugly. I view politics as war. You put your foot down on that neck and you snap it. You know, that's how I view it. And that's what Carl did here. But Richard, if you can tell us a little bit, you wrote the letter exposed, what I thought was exposing something that we all knew as people who knew the Republican Party. And I thought it was the greatest thing to have done to begin the process of the people reclaiming the Republican Party versus it being controlled by a few insiders. If you can touch on a bit on that, as well as your thoughts on this race.
Yeah, absolutely. So look, in all of San Diego County politics, there's only three individuals that I would be concerned about going up against in a campaign from the standpoint of they are strategic masterminds and no one works harder than them. And one of those individuals is Carl DeMille. And I don't think anyone, right, left, or center in San Diego County would deny that probably no one works harder than Carl DeMille in politics. Like, man, that guy is a one-man wrecking crew. Now, that being said, I find a lot of his tactics distasteful. And I find a lot of how he's treated members of the Republican Party to be distasteful. And I think Carl could have used his platform over the years in a much better way to advance, you know, the center-right coalition than he has. That all being said, when it came down to the endorsement for this particular race, Andrew Hayes won the endorsement with a two-thirds vote of the San Diego Central Committee Republican Party. After the primary took place and Carl won that primary handedly, there was an effort made by the chairwoman at that time to unilaterally rescind the endorsement of Andrew Hayes, which was a violation of past practices of the party bylaws, where once that vote was decided that Andrew Hayes had the endorsement, the only way to truly rescind that endorsement would be for the central committee body itself to vote to rescind that endorsement, not through a unilateral movement by the chair. So the letter you're referencing, William, is a letter I had sent to the central committee, making them aware of what was taking place here and why it was wrong. It was less about Andrew and Carl and just more about following the procedures and policies of the Republican Party, because unless you have a party that actually follows its own rules, it's very, very difficult to attract donor money into the party. It's very difficult to attract candidates that are going to trust the party and raise money into the party. So at the end of the day, at the end of the day, Carl won that race. He brought a flamethrower to a knife fight, as you said, and he's a one-man wrecking crew for better or worse.
That is true. And the reason I think that your letter was important is when I first got involved in 2015, I had been told Tony Kovarik had done stuff like that. And we all love Tony, too. But there's rules to be followed. And he kind of unilaterally made certain decisions that didn't sit well with members of the Central Committee. But at the end of the day, Tony had all the power. So your letter kind of exposed it, opened it up. And I think with Corey Gustafson, we had the opportunity to kind of like reset ourselves. Now, Miss Annette, when Amy was a guest on our show, I sat there and brought up the fact that Carl owes much of his success in building his foundation to his radio show. He's got the name recognition. The Voice of San Diego had an article about this race, and when they polled and talked to people, well, we really weren't all that into it, but I did know Carl's name, so I voted for him. You know, and to me, that is, so his shellacking, a big part of it had to do with name recognition. And that's why I was so angry at Andrew. I can count on one hand how many times Andrew was out during this past 2 years of campaigning versus Carl DeMaio, at least once every 4 months, coming to my district, Valley Center. You know, so Carl knew how to campaign. What are your thoughts on Carl and the fact that he did have this name recognition?
Wow, I have so much that I would love to say about this. I guess I just want to ask a question first, though, because I met Carl for the first time in this election and was at a luncheon where he spoke, and I found him to be very interesting to listen to and knowledgeable and really charismatic, actually. But again, like controlling and not that sincere. And that troubled me because my question is like, you said this, you're the one who said this, William, one of our previous shows, that you think he would fight for people. And that's really what I want. This is what I think politics doesn't have to be a blood sport. Why is it, is my question. Why can't people, the best person for the job, you know what I mean, be presented in that way? Why does it get this way? I don't know. I mean, don't laugh at me, William.
I'm not laughing at you. I can answer that real quick. It's because of contracts given out to private corporations and money. Right. And you're talking millions and millions of dollars in contracts. So there's a lot of power, whether you're a city council member, whether you're assembly member, state senator, mayor, or whatever. G and Richard, you want to chime in on that for Annette?
Well, there's no power on the school board. There you go.
I think it's human nature, right? It's human nature. I think ego gets in the way a lot. And so once you decide to run for a race, mm-hmm. and someone else is running for that same race, well, then personalities get in the way and your ego gets in the way. And unfortunately, more often than not, it becomes a win at all costs kind of mentality, even if that means, you know, destroying someone that has a great character like Andrew Hayes.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I sit there and say you put your foot on their neck and snap, but you only do that with the worst of the opponents. If somebody wants to run straight up, hey, let's have a debate on the issues on this or that. Most people are game for that. It's just since the turn of the century, and it probably started with Clinton, for those of you old enough to remember, that's when politics started to change a bit, to go from, hey, we're going to be men, you know, debate this properly, to the dirty mudslinging happened. G, any final words on this before we move on?
Yeah, I would just say that, you know, how many circles did I fill in on that ballot? It was at least 15, and I don't have the time, and I don't think anyone has the time to like try to figure out who the better person is. I just have to rely on someone else having done that homework and going and trusting them, right? So I think that's a large part of it. I mean, you know, do you know how good of a person the judge you voted for really is? Like,
but is the concern right now with Carl that he's going to take over the Central Committee?
But see, that's part of politics. He's setting his people up to run to be put there. I don't fault him for that. It's one of those things that you got to put pressure on the Central Committee to do what's right. Everybody has to be pressured in politics to an extent. Richard, you wanted to say something there.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, Annette, you're exactly right. That is a concern by many, that the Central Committee has now been kind of co-opted, if you will, by Carl, because Carl was able to get a lot of folks on the Central Committee. Now, in Carl's defense, I will say that, yeah, if I had the resources to stack the deck on the Central Committee and get everyone on the Central Committee that I believe shares my vision of what the Republican Party should look like in San Diego County, then I'd probably do it. Now, in my mind, I'm doing it, you know, out of good intentions, but we all know where the road is paved with good intentions too. And so I think Carl is using his resources to influence the party in a way that he believes is either best for the party or best for Carl DeMaio's vision of what the party should be. But yeah, it is a political tactic, and Carl brings with him a lot of resources, and he was able to implement that.
Right, Carl's only weakness is Carl. Traditionally, he has always put his foot in his mouth. This is the first race since his city council win where he has not put his foot in his mouth and lost a vote. And even then, he almost did with the whole endorsement issue. So if Carl can just clean himself up and realize, hey, we know you're going to be with the Republicans as long as it aligns with what Carl DeMaio wants, to maybe start thinking outside of that box. And I think he could be a force to be reckoned with for good. All right, so let's move to our last election here. I view Kevin Faulkner. I've never been a fan of Kevin Faulkner. He just strikes me as more of a face for the donor, an individual who is the donors, the elites, the party leaders, they look at as their guy. So his shellacking of 56% to 44%, is that right? He got shellacked. I'm not sure if my numbers are correct there, but he got shellacked in that race. I knew he would get shellacked. He was not the right candidate. I hate to say this, but you can kind of see when a politician tries to play both sides. And that's how I've always viewed him. I always thought he was a fluke when he ran for mayor and got it, you know. So I've never been impressed with him. This election, I think it was icing on the cake for his exit from politics. And those are just my thoughts on him. I don't have anything personal against him. I don't really know him. He's just, when I just researched him, found out about him, heard him talk, you're just not the candidate that I care for. Gee, your thoughts.
Yeah, I thought about running in for that county seat as well, but then the numbers just don't look good. I mean, it's the majority Democrat seat. I'm not sure that it really speaks to Faulkner's strengths or weaknesses, because I believe he left the mayorship as a very popular mayor. He just termed out. And I think, Richard, you were also potentially thinking about that seat as well. It would be a tough Juan seat. And I'm looking at the percentages here from today's dump. It's 57% to 43%. So
yeah,
I don't think that's just along the coast. It's a tough district. And I think it was after the redistricting. And remember, that was Gaspar's seat as well. And she lost because of that redistricting as well.
I think, Annette, part of the problem here is how the state has dictated to the local county how you need the campaign. I've yet to discover any recent Republican going into actual blue districts and knocking on doors. That, as a Latino who was born middle class, who has, when I go visit back home, it's always in the poor barrios, you know, those candidates who get out in those districts. And the reason I say this is in about 2016, 2012, I can't remember, she's Puerto Rican, actually, but she moved to South Carolina, was pretty big into politics. She was part of a church group going into Riverside, knocking on Latino doors with Spanish-speaking speakers. They all thought their Democrat representatives were pro-life, was doing what they wanted to do because they just didn't pay attention. So I think in this type of district, part of our Achilles heel is we just do not seem to want to go out there and actually knock on doors. Our candidates themselves don't want to do that. And I do see Democrat candidates going out and knocking. Annette, what are your thoughts on Faulkner?
Oh, my gosh. Wait. I have like three things to say. You are so right in what you said. It's so funny that you said it, William, because just today at lunch, Amy said, I don't understand why the Republicans don't have a game where they go to people's homes, that the mailers are not going to cut it. You have to go and you have to talk to people. You have to canvass.
A ground game.
That's what she said, a ground game. Thank you for saying it. The other thing about Kevin, I don't know, was he that popular, G, with the Chargers? I don't know. I've always thought him to be a dud. But that's separate than what I also think is that what I find fascinating about politics, why is it hard for people to realize that they're done? And why didn't he shift to saying, I'm not going to run in this race? Richard, I think you would have actually, you could have maybe beat her. G, I love you like more than anybody beside my husband. You're one of my favorite people on the planet. I think
what about us?
No, I know. But I just, what I'm saying is like, why doesn't it get to the point where he says, now I've done politics, but I could mentor somebody. I can help the younger people come up. I can be supportive of them and their races to see. I think he should have seen that he did not stand a chance. I don't know why in the world What is wrong with, is it the Lincoln Club? What is wrong with these people that they pick someone like him? I don't understand it at all.
I think part of it is he can raise money. But Richard, on the ground game, it's in the notes. So I don't know if you guys saw it, but right around 2009, 2010, we had a vibrant ground game. It was vibrant. I can't remember her name. She's married to a dentist. They had all the preseason captains. Because I looked her up. I tried to get a hold of her. And I tracked her down to a dentist's office. Her and her husband owned a dentist practice. They had built a robust ground game. Then State Party came down and said, this is our new way of campaigning. And I know this because Tony Kovarik explained all this to me. And we lost our ground game. And Richard, I think these shellackings, part of it is due to lack of a ground game. I mean, whatever your thoughts are on Kevin Fogden, we want to hear it. But I also want to hear your thoughts as an active candidate right now in the major position in terms of the ground game and its importance.
Look, there's when you're considering who to vote for, name ID is far and away the most important indicator of whether or not someone will cast a ballot for your name, right? Have you heard of the individual? Second to that is, do you like the individual, right? What's their favorable, unfavorables? And then the third biggest indicator, and way, 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 way down the list, like way below the first and second one, is do I agree with their policies?
Seriously? And
yeah, no question about it. Yes. It is, have I heard of you? Do I like you? And even if I don't like you, but I've heard of you, and I haven't heard of the other candidate, I'm going to most likely vote for you unless I absolutely hate you. And then it's really policies are way far down the list. It's a distant third. And so, like, the importance of a ground game is it's a way to introduce candidates to voters that aren't going to be persuaded by mail, that might be a bit tuned out, and it's a way to get in front of them. Now, the difficult part of a ground game in a district this large is you're looking at roughly 350,000 voters, which are spread out over 200,000 homes. Obviously, it's impossible for a single candidate to get to each one of those homes. But if you do have a good ground game in place, you can make up the difference. You can host meet and greets that are well attended. Like, there's ways around it, but it's difficult. Carl DeMaio does a really good job of this. Like, he really does. And as it relates to this district, it is a difficult district. It really is. And I think the benefit Kevin brought to this race is his high name ID. And so that's what gave him a leg up at the start of the race. So once again, getting back to the number one indicator if someone's going to vote for you is whether or not they've heard of you. This is why the early polling showed that Kevin fared pretty well against Tara. And I think that shaped a lot of conversations early on within the donor community of, hey, which horse should we back here? Who gives us the best chance to take over the county board of supervisors? And man, I know Kevin, I like Kevin, and this race was the one that I was personally most bummed about, because even though, you know, some of our friends on the political right, you know, a lot of them, you know, aren't necessarily super enthusiastic at the grassroots level about Kevin, fact of the matter is Kevin would be far, far better on policy than our current supervisor, Tara Lawson-Reamer, and it would have shifted the balance of power on the county board of supervisors. So I was bummed to see Kevin lose this. It was a tough seat, no question about it. And it wasn't for lack of funding, like G was saying. I mean, Kevin and the supporters put together probably close to $3 million in funding, and it just couldn't get it done.
So I'll push back on that a little bit. I am a student of history, and everything you said, take Kevin Costner, I'm sure he likes that comparison, Kevin Faulkner out and put in Bonnie Dumanis. Same storyline. She got shellacked. It's not always the name recognition. And to me, it's those boots on the ground. And Richard, you're right. Carl does not knock on doors. Carl works with the local groups and gets these gatherings to come to him, but he's always in various parts of that district to hit him up. There's ways around it. And when I first started this, Kevin Faulkner came out to give us a pep talk when we were walking for him when he was running for reelection for mayor. You know, and he wasn't knocking on any doors. And I kind of found that distasteful. That was my first interaction with him. I'm like, this guy, we're out here sweating. I mean, at least pretend you're going to go walk. Pretend you're going to walk to a door and then get in the car and take off, you know. But I'll give that pushback in that sense. Early, we are fooled early on. Well, because Bonnie Dumanis stacked up nicely. I remember hearing the radio interviews. She's got the name recognition. She's got the donor money. They like her. She's probably going to win this. And she came up to me. I hear you don't think I can win that race. And I'm like a little peon. And I told her why. I said, this is what I think you need to do. And I was proven right. I kind of stuck out with my bright red fedora, my red vest and all that. So, all right, let's go on. I'm sorry. Any final comments on that? Go ahead, Annette.
Oh, no. Are we, because I want to make sure that before, I know G's going to sign off, but before we go, I have a question for, I have a question for Richard. Are we not there yet? Are we not at the end of the show?
Oh, no, we're going to cover the first measure. There's two measures, but they're the same thing. They're just one county, one city. This was Richard's request. and it actually works out well because we may have lost to Democrats on a one-to-one candidate, but we won a lot of these props in pushing back taxes. And this was Measure G and Measure E, and I'll combine them because they both dealt, in essence, with taxes.
Before you go to there, I want to say bye. My kids are calling me, and I've got to run. I'm glad I could stay longer than I was able.
Good to see you, G.
Yeah, good to see you guys. Thank you.
Good night, G.
All right, brother, take care. So we'll close it with this one here. But, Richard, your thoughts on both measures. They were really – I mean, am I wrong in my research? I saw that they were pretty much just – don't want to say tax grabs – because it looked like they would have helped some stuff, but it seems like the same old tropes with every tax bill that comes from the county and the city.
Yeah, there were both sales tax increases. So Measure G was a sales tax increase that would have applied countywide, and then Measure E was a sales tax increase that would have applied strictly to the city of San Diego. And what I find fascinating about these two measures is that in parts of the city of San Diego, where you have voters that supported Kamala Harris by 30%, and in that same district, they supported Tara Lawson-Reamer by 20% over Kevin, they ended up opposing these sales tax measures and also supporting Prop 36 and also narrowly supporting Larry Turner. And so it really kind of calls into question here, you know, if voters are supporting a candidate at a national level whose policies are the opposite of what they're supporting at the local level, are voters finally starting to kind of wake up? And now they haven't connected the dots between the national candidates and their position with the local policies, but at the local level, they're starting to really, when they vote on policies, they tend to vote in a very moderate / conservative position. And I think that's encouraging for the future of San Diego County.
Richard, I think you brought up a good point in going back to Faulkner when you said policies are way down. When they look at the candidates, they don't think policies. But this is a number straight in their face. No more taxes. Yet our candidates aren't able to elevate. This is what your opponent supports. So I think you're right. It's like we have to get them to connect the dots. Again, I will stand by my ground game. That's how you get them to connect the dots. Ms. Annette, your thoughts?
No, Richard, what you just said made me think of what you said previously about Mike Levin. Is that how you say his name?
Yes.
That he comes off as like very even tempered and so a moderate guy, but actually he votes very left. Maybe people, like you said, aren't connecting the dots. If they were realizing how far to the left he was actually voting, he might not be representing them really well as they would want to be represented if these props are really true, and it seems like they are, that this is where people stand on these local issues.
So I always tell people – I'm sorry, Annette, go ahead.
No, but that is great, though. That is a sign of hope. People just
right.
There's so much people don't know. I do think that is true. I do think there is a lot – even for me, I'm new to politics in a way, and even on the show I'm learning so much. But, like, there is a lot of – I don't want to say it in a bad way, but just ignorance. They just don't know.
Naivety is a better word. Naivety. People, Richard, what I always say is I served on the planning group here in Valley Center is when things get local, Democrats have a funny way of becoming very conservative because they don't want it in their backyard. They don't want that to cost. It's we just have to connect the dots. And I think we can do it. We just have to change our party structure and how we run it. But with that said, great conversation today. Richard, is there anything you want to give out your social media, whatever you want to pump up, have at it.
Yeah, right on. I mean, if viewers would like to stay in touch, I am on Instagram and Twitter. I think my handle is just simply RichardBailey_. They can find me. They can find me if they search hard enough. And anyways, I've enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. I'll make sure I'll dig those out and we'll get them in our notes.
I have a question for Richard, William.
Knock yourself out.
Richard, I want to know what you've enjoyed about being the mayor of Coronado.
Oh, wow. There's a lot. But I would say the thing I have enjoyed most, and that I'm really starting to kind of reflect back on now, is just all the amazing relationships, amazing people I met along the way, including yourself, including you now, William. and it's a unique position, right, to represent an entire city, especially a city like Coronado, which I think punches above its weight class, right? We're only a city of 26,000, but we're known throughout the world. And so, yeah, it's been a tremendous honor, and I've been able to develop so many amazing friendships along the way, and I'm forever grateful for those.
And Richard, we indirectly met. I emailed your campaign. I'm like, I'm in Valley Center. Why am I getting the Mayor Coronado's
Christmas card?
Mailer. So I sent it back. Hey, you want to save some money? So take me off the list. And you emailed me back and said, I appreciate your concern, but all that's automated.
Yeah. It's true.
To the audience, thank you for tuning in. You can find this podcast, Fired Up, as well as my other sports and politics podcast, Points on the Board, and my pop culture and politics podcast, Red, White, and Rude, and I kick ass in those too, at grumblingsmedia.com, on our social media platforms, YouTube, Rumble, Apple, Spotify, and Pandora, and like, share, and subscribe. And to everybody, my name is William Del Pilar for the panel here. Until next week, we bid you adieu.